from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Dave Iverson. In our first hour of Forum, bankruptcies, layoffs, idle factories, and falling real estate values. It's hardly unique to the United States. In his cover article in the April issue of The Atlantic magazine, journalist James Fallows describes how the global recession is affecting China. The economic downturn is putting a huge dent in demand for products made in China, and it's putting the brakes on one of the world's most potent economies. At the same time, the U.S. is depending on China to loan us money. We'll talk to James Fallows about this confluence of economic trends and what it means for the future of both countries. That's our topic this hour of Forum, and we hope you'll join us right after this. And welcome to this hour of Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Dave Iverson. Well, like most countries in the world right now, China's usually booming economy is suffering. It's the same problems we see here: unemployment, falling demand for products, bankruptcies, the usual symptoms of economic recession. In his cover story for the April Atlantic magazine titled China's Way Forward, James Fallows writes that China may be down, but it certainly isn't out. In fact, he writes, China seems to be making very good use of the downturn in ways that could leave it even stronger than before. And James Fallows is with me here in the studio to talk about what he found in China. Jim Fallows, welcome.
Mr. Schaefer, thanks very much for having me here.
Well, let's before we get to the current moment in China, let's talk about the summer games and what the environment, the atmosphere, the hopes for the future were like in China as those games were pulled off so successfully.
It's amazing that there's only 6 months ago that Beijing was still basking just in the Paralympics were still going on after the normal Olympics. And there was this 2 month period in which the officials in charge of the country, and I think many average Chinese people, too, felt as if something successful had been pulled off. There were so many things which made the Olympics a sort of close-run matter, especially the pollution, which as of about 48 hours into the opening of the Games was still really disastrous. And so it took a big cold front moving through from Mongolia and then some previous measures to clear things up. And so there was this sense of sort of omnicompetence and omnipossibility with only the slightest little edge of China uber alles. I think that was a very muted tone, but just kind of relief and satisfaction that things had worked. And as we all know, September and October after the Olympic and Paralympic Games, things started going wrong in the world economy, the U.S. economy, and especially because of what happened to the U.S. consumer economy. All these factories in China that had been churning stuff out for us in the U.S. suddenly were shutting down too.
So the reality today then, you write in your article, a lot of unemployment, massive unemployment. So what happens in a country like China when the factories are shut down, at least temporarily?
Well, there's a couple of things that to me are interesting. One is, as you say, massive unemployment. Anything that happens in China is massive just because
Fair
of the scale of everything. I was down in southern China in a place called Dongguan, which is generally in the area of Shenzhen. This is the immediately north of Hong Kong. It's what's been the manufacturing center of China for the last 10 or 15 years. And this Dongguan area has specialized in the really what you think of as classic Chinese junk, little $1.99 type toys, very low, very cheap prices here and very low wages for the people who make them. And I was told by a local official that within a mile of where we were standing, something like a million jobs had vanished just in the air in the factories we could see. So there is considerable economic churn. I explain in my article, we can go into it later, why the unemployment effects in China are actually likely to be much greater than in the U.S. or in their customer countries in the year or two ahead. What's happening to those people actually is the question for China now. Operationally, many, many, many of them were migrants from the countryside, so they're going back to the same little villages that they came from. It's difficult to know how exactly they are being reabsorbed there and with what frictions, et cetera, but that's the main sort of domestic question for China, how these tens of millions of displaced people, what's going to happen to them in the short and medium term.
And you describe in the article what that outflow of people looks like.
You can see it. It's not a purely theoretical flow when you're in the big Chinese cities. It's surprisingly easy. My wife and I have now been living in China for almost 3 years. We moved to Shanghai in the summer of 2006. We'll be in Beijing until the summer of this year. We'll move back to Washington after 3 years in China. And it is really easy to pick out people in the big cities who are not from the big cities, people who are migrants for construction projects like building Beijing before the games, for the big factories, for all sorts of things. They look different. Their skin is usually darker. It certainly is much more weathered. They're wearing clothes that they obviously wear every single day. Their hands are cracked and calloused. They just look like country people, a kind of difference probably you could have seen in the U.S. 100 years ago when people were coming to Detroit or Chicago. And so the flow we observed in Beijing is just before the Olympic Games, we could see all these country people with their bundles of stuff on the long-distance buses headed out of Beijing. Soon after...
Not because the factories were closed.
Oh, no, sorry. Yes, that was because the city was, quote, cleaning up, unquote, for the games. Any construction project that wasn't going to be finished by about the beginning of July, they just put a freeze on and sent the people home so there would be a more presentable air to Beijing. After the games, they started pouring back in. You see the buses coming in from Hebei and other places were full of people. And then around October, I started seeing the outbound buses again, where people, construction projects were being closed off again, and things were being put on hold. And these poor people, I mean, poor in all senses of the term, were going back home.
Relative to the rest of China, though, these folks were making money in the factories, not getting paid well. So they go back and presumably sending money back to their villages?
Yes.
So what happens? What's the trickle-down effect?
The trickle-down of their having been employed has been profound, and it really is the Chinese drama of the last generation. This is something, as a side note, I'll say I describe in my recently published book, Postcards from Tomorrow Square, about how how tens of millions of people have moved essentially from the $100 per year cash economy in the countryside to the $100 per month cash economy.
Huge difference.
It's just a huge difference. And so the money goes back. The individuals often go back home. Sometimes they don't. But the money makes a difference in their villages. And the question now is when these people in their 20s and 30s who have been working in the cities go back to the countryside, how long they stay there, what they find to do there. There is a lot of absorptive capacity in Chinese society because it's been through a lot. And my guess is there's not going to be widespread rural riots, but nobody really knows what's happening.
So are they going back to the farms? Are they going back to agriculture?
Typically, people will have come from farming villages where there's a variety of just small activities that people undertake. It is... I've been able to travel a lot in rural China, and you hear these cliches of a billion people living in poverty, 800 million, and it's not as if you go and see some massive slum scene like in Mumbai in the recent Slumdog movie, but you just see one little village after another where people are just farming as they might have for 300 years ago, and they just are making do with the stuff they grow and the little few things they can buy. So these people, they can be reabsorbed up to a certain point, and actually there's some value because it's been mainly old people and children left on the farm over the last generation as young people have gone to the cities. But clearly, at a certain point, this won't be so great.
Is there any sense of disillusionment this great leap forward, pardon the expression, this economic advancement that's occurred in the past decade or so, that maybe it wasn't such a great idea because now look at the fallout when the world catches a cold, we have the flu.
I think to generalize, as almost everything I'm saying is, I'd say no. I'd say, if anything, that there is, and I'm even allowing for the state-controlled media, the sort of agitprop you get from all the official spokesmen all the time. Most Chinese people, in my experience of the many, many tens of thousands I've had a chance to interact with in some way over the last 3 years, feel as if the direction of the country's progress is basically good. Yes, there are problems. Yes, there are also people being arbitrarily detained, et cetera, et cetera. But most people's family story has been brighter in the last 10 years than in the previous century, where China's been through all this disaster and turmoil. So I have not detected in interviewing people in factories, even ones who have been laid off, they blame the factory owner, they blame the local mayor, but they don't say, gee, China is on the wrong course of history.
My guest this hour is James Fallows. He's got the cover story in the upcoming Atlantic magazine. It's called China's Way Forward. And as he just alluded to, he's got a new book out called Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China, a compilation of stories you've written over the past
yes,
2 years.
Most of the book is a chronicle of things I've had in the Atlantic, mainly Atlantic, over since starting in the fall of 2006. Plus, there's new material on what China's been like more recently.
Yeah. In this country, the first signs of the economic downturn were some of the mortgage problems, the foreclosures. To what extent has that been a problem in China?
it's a much less of a problem there, just because the whole mortgage and consumer banking industry is much less highly developed, quote unquote, or perniciously developed, or however ours has been. And yes, and also because over the last couple of years, as I also have explained in my book and in The Atlantic, that China has essentially been the source of the savings that Americans have borrowed. And so the essential logic of the real estate and credit boom that's now crashing and collapsing in the U.S. is that over the last 10 years, Chinese people have been living lower than they potentially could have, so that we could be living higher than we theoretically should have. And so there isn't the same credit bubble to collapse in the same way. There are local real estate bubbles and all that, but it's a different situation.
Well, and in fact, we did a story on the California Report last week about Chinese real estate tourists coming here looking at property in California, because there are still a lot of people with cash looking for places to park it.
Yes. As with many, many things in China, opposite assertions are simultaneously true. So it's simultaneously true that most people in China are really, really poor and have some money and have no money. And a lot of people in China who have a ton of money, and that U.S. real estate is beginning to look comparatively attractive for reasons people here in my home state know all too well. I think a meta point we could make here is that we know that over the last decade, China has been financing the U.S. in a variety of ways, in mortgage loans, in government bonds, whatever. It's not simply charity on the Chinese people's and investors' part. They have all this money from the trade surplus that they have to do something with. And so, like other people, say with a 401k, what has been the most prudent way for them to do it? So far, it's been mainly to buy U.S. treasuries and maybe U.S. real estate. And they might change that if this looks like a riskier long-term investment for them.
And what about the China stock market?
Chinese stock market, I think, is best compared to a giant mahjong table or whatever. I had this heartbreaking episode when I moved to Shanghai in the summer of 06. And the Shanghai stock exchange, then one of two big exchanges in China, the other one being in Shenzhen, was beginning a historic ascent. Let's say it was around the 3,000 level then. It's more or less that. I had a young graduate assistant who was working with me as an interpreter. And his mother had been a factory worker in Shanghai. And as the market went up and up, he's saying, oh, they're borrowing all the money they could and putting her life savings into the Shanghai stock exchange because they knew the government would not let it fall during the auspicious year of the Olympics 2008, et cetera, et cetera. Of course, the market went up to 6,000 or so, and then it had a crash much, much worse than ours. I think it's lost three quarters of its value or so. Now it's coming back up, but there's a reason why it's actuarially true that ethnically Chinese people like gambling more than other ethnicities. There are scientific studies of this, which I also describe in my off-mentioned book. And the stock exchange is fundamentally a gambling enterprise there. Not to say that much about ours, but
so has that notion that the government won't let it fail, and that it did. Did that undermine faith in the central government?
That's an interesting question. I have not seen a lot of assertions of that. I mean, I think there is some sense in people's bones of the stock exchange in China being non-transparent, as we say. And also, they've seen stock exchanges gyrate wildly all around the world. I think what would really – I guess I'd make two points on this undermining faith question. One is most of the protest which is going on in China now, which is vociferous in many cases, is usually locally directed. If a factory worker is laid off, he's really ready to kill the boss who didn't pay him his back wages. If people get evicted from their apartment for lack of payment, they hate the landlord. There's surprisingly little "the system must change" type rhetoric. That is one. Yeah.
And to what extent do you think that's because it's acceptable to protest at the local level, maybe not so much at the national level?
That's a good point. I think there are a multiplicity of regions. There's an enormous propaganda machine which conditions what people hear on a whole variety of things, from the way the internet is managed to the way the media, which are all controlled, put out the central message of the wisdom and goodness of our leaders and how they're always concerned about the little people. There's also the fact that the Chinese government, surprisingly for Americans, can be quite deft in sensing areas of internal discontent and addressing them. I say surprising for Americans because when the Chinese government speaks to us, it does so with a tin ear and just no success at all. Classic example is calling the Dalai Lama a jackal in Buddhist monk's robes. But internally, they're much shrewder about saying there's going to be unemployment here. Let's have some more benefits. There's going to be this or that issue. Let's find some way to address it. And so While it is certainly possible to have resentment at the central authorities rise for all sorts of reasons, it usually is shunted towards lower levels.
You make it in the article sort of the question, well, where is this going? Where does this lead to? Is this what we saw with the Soviet Union in the 1980s, where it was the central mismanagement of the government which led to a fundamental catastrophic collapse? Is it like Japan in the 90s, where we feared this rising Japanese power and then it fell into a terrible recession? Explain what is the right model for looking at what's happening there now.
The reason I introduced both of those mental models at the beginning of the article is I think that when people talk about the end of China or the collapse of China or the breakup of China, often at some level they have in mind either the Soviet or the Japanese case. The Soviet case is the idea that there will be popular rebellion against an authoritarian, in the Soviet case, a totalitarian system because of economic failure. And the difference here is that there are many, many differences. Modern China politically is obviously controlling and repressive, but nothing like Stalin's Soviet Union. You know, Mao's China was that way. Hu Jintao's is much more selective in the way that it represses. I think the difference here is that the Soviet Union never succeeded economically. So there was a half century of economic failure that people finally rebelled against. In China, the economic troubles are of the last 6 months, and they come on the back of the last 30 years of general ascent for most people economically. And the troubles even now are there have been worse troubles than this that people have seen. So there is that difference from the Soviet model. There is a sense, I think most people would agree, that for the majority of Chinese people, the economic prospects have been brighter over the last generation, and so that gives some legitimacy to the government. The Japanese model, I think, is based on the idea that the Japanese financial system has been in a 20-year freeze-up or logjam, and that's because Japan was not really willing to adapt to the outside world. Manufacturing is still strong. Its finance is poor. The evidence to me, I think, suggests the Chinese are much more agile than the Japanese authorities have been in changing to match the realities of the outside world.
And you say in the article that perhaps the right model, or someone you spoke to who you respect in China, that the right model they suggest is the United States in the 1920s.
Yes, and this is – I'll give the one-minute version of this. This is mainly – it's an analogy which mainly has bad implications for China in the short term, although brighter ones in the long term. This is a guy named Michael Pettis, who is an American national economist now who's lived in Beijing for a long time. By night, he's a rock impresario. He runs rock music clubs. In the daytime, he teaches at a management school, a business school. And his point in its purest form is that what happened to the U.S. in the 1920s and the 1930s probably is going to happen to China in this sense. In the 1920s, the U.S. had trade surpluses with everybody. It was the workshop of the world, and it was lending money to everybody and became the big creditor nation. That's what China has done in the last 10 years. It's the workshop of the world, trade surpluses with everybody, and now has all these capital surpluses invested around the world. That is a strength in many ways. It means that when demand collapses among the customers, as it did in the 1930s for America's customers and is doing now for China's, the unemployment effects are much worse in the previous surplus country. The U.S. had worse unemployment in the 30s than Europe did. Europe had other real terrible problems, but it didn't have as much unemployment. And therefore, by this reasoning, China is going to have even bigger unemployment than we do because they've had a larger share of the world's jobs for the last 10 years, so they have more to lose.
But of course, we emerged from World War II in part, clearly much stronger in part because we weren't devastated by the war the way Europe was.
Indeed. And we're hoping this analogy does not have a World War II at the end of it. And Michael Pettis doesn't suggest it does. But I did try to see how our Chinese firms and Chinese leaders using the opportunity, as you suggest, of this coming economic hardship to rebuild for a better future. And I did find such evidence of they're trying to say, okay, 10 years from now, however long it's going to be, we'll be back with a different kind of product.
And give us an example of that product. What might it be?
Well, I think the most dramatic example, and I'll say the larger point here is that China's success for the last 20 years has been based essentially on low-wage manufacturing. Almost everything China has succeeded in is either construction, roads, airports, whatever, what have you, and cheap manufacturing. They recognize the cheap manufacturing trap and want to rise up. And so the best illustration so far is a company called the BYD Company of Shenzhen in southern China, which has built the world's most advanced, as of this moment, battery-powered car. It's a plug-in car. The way they did this, it's about a 15-year-old company. They are the world's leading company now in batteries for cell phones and iPods and all the rest, cameras, et cetera. And they said, if we are so good at building batteries, let's just build a great big battery and build a car around it, which is what they've done. Now, people make fun of the styling of this car. It's not that great, but it works better than anything that U.S. or European or Japanese manufacturers have done so far. So,
and like so many things coming out of China, it's affordable.
Yes, yes.
$22,000?
I saw it at the press conference announcing it in early January in southern China, and people were aghast at the same price, $22,000, $24,000. I thought, oh, this is so expensive. That got people's attention as being cheap when it was announced later at the Detroit Motor Show.
And as Kevin Gilroy, our producer, just pointed out, the version of that being built in Silicon Valley at Tesla was about $100,000.
Yes.
So an extraordinary difference there.
And it's partly partly differences in labor costs and all that, but the factory in which they do this in southern China is amazing. I don't have time to give the full story here, but essentially they say China's strength is that we have a whole lot of people, and so they try to minimize all the hardware they can and have it done by human labor. There are no robots in this car factory. Every car works in the rest of the world has all these industrial robots. They have people doing these things.
And it's still cheap.
Yes.
And, you know, we've heard Barack Obama talking about, in fact, batteries. Why aren't we making these batteries in the United States? Does that mean the U.S. is hip to what's going on there and trying to do a version of that here? Or is that just, futile?
One would certainly hope the U.S. is doing this. And I will actually move to the inspiring last paragraph of this article I have coming out. When I say that China is really being hit by a lot of forces, and I discuss some of the ways in which they might respond, which would be pernicious for them and for us too. And then I say there are ways in which they are trying for their own interest to move up the value chain, move up the technology chain, and no one can possibly blame them for that. That's what every economy tries to do. All that we can do is say, how are we using this moment right now when all economic fundamentals are being called into question? So the question is, will the U.S. be able to invest properly in its batteries and its infrastructure and energy and everything else that is familiar here? So China is in many ways doing what it needs to for its future. Query, what about us?
And what are the implications for the rest of the world if China succeeds?
I think it's a shift in what China's economy portends. I have argued consistently in the last 3 years that China's economy surprisingly has been on the whole positive in its interaction with the rest of the world, in that despite the dislocations it's brought to some manufacturing workers here and some in Mexico and in Europe, I think you can demonstrate that more jobs have actually been created in the U.S. and in Europe and in Mexico because of China's role of being complementary to foreign firms than was the case, say, with Japan's rise, which I thought was more zero-sum than China's has been. But if China is able to be more of a center of high-value work itself, that is more head-to-head competitive with us.
And so the Made in China label, would that be replaced by Made in somewhere else? I mean, they still have a lot of people they need to put to work in factories.
Yes, they do have a lot of people they need to put to work in factories. And it's I have no quick answer to that question, but I just that's why I'll head back there in 2 days to watch it some more.
James Fallows, his article China's Way Forward is on the cover of the Atlantic Magazine's April issue. He's also written a new book called Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China, and we'll have much more with him in the second half of this hour. We'd like you to join the conversation. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. Again, 866-733-6786, or if you prefer, you can email us. It's forum@kqed.org. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, in today for Dave Iverson. And my guest this hour is James Fallows, longtime journalist with The Atlantic Magazine. In fact, he's got the cover story in the April issue. It's called China's Way Forward. And also a new book out called Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China, reports that you've written between 2006, 2008, and some new material,
as is crucial to point out.
Crucial to point out. Let's bring our listeners into the conversation. And again, the phone number, 866-733-6786. Let's go to the phones. And Jason is on the line in Oakland. Hi, Jason.
Hi. There's two areas which a lot of journalists don't concentrate on with regards to business in China. The first area is that they're not just buying our T-bills to invest their money. It's the only way they can keep dollars in high demand and keep their currency artificially low. So they have to buy our T-bills to keep their currency low and keep exporting cheap products to us. And then, and in fact, recently in the New York Times, it was reported just a day or two ago that they've been buying March T-bills just recently. And then secondly, the court system is controlled in China by both the national and local governments. So we had a situation where one of our customers received apparel that we had had shipped directly to them in Europe, and it was covered in formaldehyde. They hadn't finished processing it correctly. And we spoke to some lawyers, and they said, don't even bother. They wrote some letters, and that was the response they got back from their Chinese counterparts, that we really couldn't do more because the supplier didn't have an office in the U.S. to sue here. So I'd just like to know whether the author has investigated either of those areas or heard about those before.
Jim?
Thanks for your question. I actually have written about both of those in the magazine and in this book. Let me give a brief perspective on both, starting with the second. It is certainly true that the Chinese court system, well, the Chinese governmental system as a whole, the whole concept of divided powers, balance of power, check and balance simply doesn't exist there. And indeed, I think it was Premier Wen Jiabao or some other official was saying just in the last week that China did not believe in the principle of divided power or checks and balances, and they would find other ways to be accountable, blah, blah, blah. But the basic legal and political landscape is fundamentally different. Having said that, one of the interesting areas of the last 15 years has been foreign efforts led by the U.S. to expand the rule of law and civil society and transparency and procedure. And you do find areas, especially in worker safety and environmental issues, where there are cases of both Chinese citizens and foreign organizations being able actually to win lawsuits. And so it is a glass one-tenth full, perhaps, but it's sort of the one-tenth to two-tenths full aspect. But yes, transparency, rule of law is a crucial issue in China and actually an issue of contention there. On the issue of the relationship between the currency's value and the purchases of bills, yes, it is certainly true by definition that the way China – that when China receives all these payments for the goods it sells in the U.S. or anything else denominated in dollars, it has to do something with those dollars. And the way it has set its policy in the last 20 years has been essentially to keep that money in dollars, buying treasury bills, buying U.S. stock assets, et cetera, instead of changing them in, which would raise the value of their currency against the dollar. And I have a long description of what happens to a dollar from the time you spend it at Walmart to when it comes back as a treasury note. The one point on which I would have a slightly different tone than your question implies is how significant the, quote, artificially, unquote, low level of the currency actually is. Over the last – until 4 years ago, China flat pegged the value of the RMB. It was a little more than 8 to the dollar, and there was no variation at all. It's been on a so-called managed float since then. It's gotten about 25% more valuable against the dollar. Everybody knows this has some effect on trade. Most people who are working the actual exporting business in China say it's not a fundamental issue. If the RMB became 50% stronger, it still wouldn't have a fundamental effect on the competitiveness of a lot of these Chinese goods.
Jason, does that respond to your question?
Yes, I'd just like to point out that this affects not only American workers. I mean, we import our products, so but it affects other third world countries, too, who cannot manage their currency the way China can. So Africa and development, commercial development in Africa, is very much subjected to the manipulations and other non-tariff trade barriers that China imposes.
It certainly is true that China's direct competitors for a lot of Chinese manufacturers, not people in the U.S., but as you say, people in Africa, people in Southeast Asia. And I would argue that the real barrier that makes it easier to do this work in China than in, say, Ghana, where I used to live, or other places, is not so much the wage level as it is all this infrastructure China has put in place. The freeways are much better than the U.S. The ports and airports are all very highly maintained. And so this has all been subsidized by the government as part of an export export machine. And I think that even if labor in Ghana were free, Ghana doesn't have this whole infrastructure to become an exporting hub as China does.
All right, Jason, thanks so much for the call. Jim Fowles, what is the the tipping point? That we, you know, there's all this concern about, what if China stops buying treasury bills? What would make that happen?
I think it's worth recognizing the very separate short and long-term considerations that Chinese investors – by investors, I mean the managers of the Chinese overseas investment fund – have in mind. And they are similar to but a little different from those that we all have in mind as investors. Short-term, everybody says, and it's true, that if the Chinese started a big run on the dollar of saying we're going to unload our treasury notes, we're going to sell all of our American stock holdings, we're going to do all this, they would bring down the system but bring down themselves too. They have, depending on estimates, something like $2 trillion worth of U.S. dollar holdings. That's a lot of money. It's I think, the biggest pool of dollar holdings. And that would go way, way down in value, both on its face value and the currency value if they had a run. So
It would also really put a bigger dent in demand for Chinese products, right?
It would be bad all around. I'm sure there is some bear, some Bernie Madoff equivalent who could find some way to profit on it, but it'd be bad all around. Longer term, I think the calculation from China is, what's the best investment site in the long run? Is the U.S. going to continue to be the most honest, the most stable, the most predictable investment site? And I think if the U.S. lost that reputation, then it would not go here.
It's not out of charity that they're buying T-bills.
Yes, exactly.
866-733-6786. If you've got a question for James Fallows, let's go to Milpitas now. And Kevin is on the line. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. I had a question concerning private property ownership. Chinese could come to the U.S. and purchase real estate. I think that was mentioned earlier. How about Americans and other foreign entities? Are they free to purchase private land in China? And then beyond that, percentage of ownership by foreign countries for commercial or industrial sites. Could you explain that to us?
Yes, I can explain to within the limits of my knowledge. There are differences in the fundamental land ownership in China from the U.S. that affect Chinese and foreign owners too, and that at a fundamental level, the state owns the land. Weirdly, this is like – it has some similarities to the way it works in England, where the crown fundamentally owns much of the land and you buy a 99-year hold or whatever.
Or with tribal land too.
Yes, right. Yes, right. And so I think that there is that fundamental difference. But I personally know a large number of Americans, New Zealanders, Australians who own houses, who own vacation homes, who own apartments in China. So within the limits of the Chinese legal structure, it's become possible in recent years for foreigners to actually buy and own property there and to sell it and all the rest. And so that's – I don't know all the nuances, but I know that it is possible for foreigners to own businesses, properties, et cetera. On industrial sites, I don't know that. I have a parallel point, which I think is an interesting contrast with Japan, which is the relatively – in Japan, it's striking how small a direct ownership stake foreign companies have. It's mainly the big Japanese companies that own the Japanese economy. In China, a lot of the manufacturing, in fact, most of the trade surplus is accounted for by foreign-owned companies. It is the Walmarts and the GMs and the others which are doing the work in China and then sending it to the rest of the world.
What are the consequences of that?
The consequences, I think it makes the Chinese economy more open to the rest of the world, and it does bring in these fundamental questions of globalization. For example, GM is still the leading car brand in China. Yeah, the Buick is the most popular car model still. That was true as of a few months ago. I'm not sure if it's still true, but it's Buick has been very strong. So it has been good for GM, perhaps the only good thing for GM, that it has a Chinese market. And one can argue in which ways is this good and bad for its people in the U.S. and elsewhere. And that's a familiar argument.
Yeah. Kevin, thanks for the call. Let's go now to Chuck in San Francisco. Hi, Chuck.
Hi. Thanks a lot.
Sure.
It was interesting you were just talking a moment ago about obstacles to economic development in Africa. It seems to me that one of the big ones is subsidized industrial agriculture in countries, so-called economically advanced countries like ours, which leads me to my question. You were talking about rural people returning to the countryside and resuming small-scale agriculture and similar projects. I'm wondering if you see a shift away from the kind of traditional small-scale agricultural model towards a more modern, so to speak, industrial agriculture as it typically seems to characterize the sort of development that's going on there, or if you see them valuing that not only for economic reasons but cultural reasons and so forth?
That's an interesting question, which I'll start by saying I don't know enough to give an authoritative answer, but I'll tell you what I've seen. It is, you know, it's hard to say anything in general about these phenomena because the different parts of China are so different. And I've seen some wheat farming in the Ningxia area, which would be a desert, except that they're sucking all the water out of the Yellow River in a pattern familiar to those of us in California, and some of this hillside agriculture in Sichuan and elsewhere. And I guess the things which strike me are, first, there are a lot of barriers to big industrial-style agriculture as we think of it here, in that the landholdings, there are not that many giant landholdings now, things that are suitable for the very, very large-scale use. There are a tremendous number of people, so that people can be much more cheaply applied to the land than is the case, say, in the American Great Plains. And the most distorted aspect of Chinese agriculture, which is a great environmental issue, is that both the use of water and the use of pesticides have been subsidized. And so Chinese agriculture, surprisingly, is quite wasteful of water and over-pesticide-ed and over-fertilized. And so this is part of the sort of health problem with Chinese agriculture. So it has its big problems. I think large-scale Kansas and Nebraska-scale industrial agriculture, it would be difficult to practice there.
Respond to your question, Chuck?
Within the best of my limits, best of my abilities.
So it sounds like the answer is they really do value the maintaining that kind of rural agrarian model, and that's not going anywhere.
Well, I think actually, and this yes and no. I think there is. I've been in some villages, say in western Sichuan province, in the area of the earthquake, where people have said they're really glad that people are coming back from the factories because they do. There's a tremendous value in the hometown and the family and all that. I think that there's little romance of the farm in China because for so many people there, it symbolizes poverty, backwardness, benightedness, and so still it's a pre-romantic era of the peasant life.
All right. Thanks for the call, Chuck. We've got an email from Bill in Berkeley who asks, we hear much about China's contribution to carbon dioxide emissions. What are they doing to mitigate this pollution as they grow?
This, as I'm relieved to say, is also the topic of a large part of my recent writings. And it's this is one area where, surprisingly, an official Chinese government document put things correctly. There's a white paper on the environment which came out about a year ago, which said the situation concerning China's environment is grave with some positive aspects. And essentially, that's it. It's a grave situation. And there are some positive things going on. It's grave in the sense that, as everyone knows, coal is the main source that China has for its development. As people may not know quite as vividly as outside China as inside, there are a whole lot of people who simply are going to be demanding more power and more modernization. People don't all have electric lights, and they're going to want electric lights, and they're going to want refrigeration. They're going to want heat for their houses. And so you can talk, as we all should, about conservation lifestyle, but there are basic needs that a large number of people are going to want to have satisfied. So the question is how, with what effect on the world environment that will be carried out. I think while the emergency of U.S.-China relations at the moment involves financial crises and all the rest, by far the most important topic in these next 4 or 8 years for the U.S. is, can it work with China to see technologically and diplomatically how China can develop without killing everybody, including the Chinese?
And they do have a nuclear power industry.
They do. They do. And the argument that many Chinese officials make is, okay, you don't like our coal. Well, do you want us to use nuclear? Do you want us to build more dams and displace millions of people? Do you want us to you want us to buy more oil from Africa? What do you want us to do? Because almost all the alternatives are pretty bad. They do have a very advanced solar power industry in China. They have one, I think, the world's leading solar photovoltaic company and increasingly wind farms in the Northwest.
But too many people, not enough sources of power if you're just looking at those
renewables. A lot of people who want the conveniences of being heated in the winter and having lights to turn on at night.
Yeah, like us.
Yes.
866-733-6786. Adam is on the line in Santa Clara. Hi, Adam.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about taxes. How do Chinese and American government tax those companies which outsource? And do those companies which outsource have tax advantage over companies which produce in the United States?
Good question. So companies like Walmart and others that do production over there.
That's a good question. And I have to say I don't know. I don't really know the answer. I certainly don't know the answer for U.S. tax codes. Within China, these foreign-based manufacturers are a relatively attractive source of taxation for the Chinese because so much of the economy is untaxable. There's a tremendous amount of just small-scale and large-scale corruption going on in China. For example, in restaurants, it's really like pulling teeth to get a receipt from them for a meal because if they give you a receipt, they have to report the income. And so there's always a preference for just doing things in cash. So factories which operate foreign factories in China, they operate more honestly than much of the rest of the economy does, and therefore they are easier to tax. Incentives for outsourcing, I'm afraid I just don't know.
I mean, that certainly was a topic in the presidential election, and Obama still talks about not rewarding companies that outsource work to other countries.
That is the case, and this is mainly U.S. policy, which I haven't been up on, so sorry.
Yeah. All right, Adam, thanks for the call. Susan is on the line. Susan in Sacramento. Hi there.
Hi, yeah. Switching gears a little bit. A few years back, a couple years ago, I saw a film that had an interview with some young women Chinese factory workers, and it really broke my heart because, you know, they were just kind of sobbing because they were exhausted working 12-hour days. They couldn't talk when they were working. They missed their family. And I haven't heard that addressed at all in your conversation. I'm just wondering if, you know, this manufacturing boom in China, it's had positive effects in improving the standard of living of families, but it's also ripped families apart and caused, on an individual level, you know, a lot of hardship and working long hours. And I'm just wondering if you've seen any signs of that improving, if the government's going to allow the development of unions as a, you know, as a way to maybe improve the situation of the workers. You know, have you seen any signs of that at all?
This is, of course, a rich and important topic, and it's one, in fact, that I have written about a lot, although we haven't discussed it here. And there's a whole literature both of nonfiction and fictional treatments of this subject in recent books about China, including mine. And I think that here are the points I would make. Number one, it certainly is true that, as with any other form of economic disruption, this has good and bad aspects. When you travel in rural China, you typically see in the fields kids who are younger than 12 or 13 and their grandparents, because often working age people, male and female, are in the cities, are earning incomes. And this has the positive and the negative impact that it did in America 200 years ago during the great industrialization of first New England and then the South in the England of Charles Dickens' time. This is the end of Chicago and Detroit 100 years ago. So it is a positive and a disruptive factor. And there has been some talk during this recent layoff period about how there is some reunification of the families. The union question is a tricky one because, again, China is officially a communist country. And so Walmart is the only country in the world where Walmart has its workforce be unionized is inside China. And it has essentially no effect except that the unions have their monthly Communist Party morale building meeting. The main thing that has happened for workers' rights is, number one, the background effect of just demand. They've been in a stronger bargaining position over the last 5 or 6 years. And the government has actually passed some worker rights laws in the last 2 years that have had an actual influence on working hours, on rates of pay, of security of employment, and all the rest. And people in southern China say that it has had an effect on how they actually operate. So unions, maybe not so much, but the new worker rights law has had some effect.
You know, there's always talk when we discuss trade agreements in this country to say, well, we've got to have stronger labor protections. I mean, to what extent have agreements with the U.S. had an impact on those policies?
My impression is that that has had less of an impact than internal Chinese dynamics and development where, for example, I mentioned earlier the government, for all of its crudeness in dealing with the outside world, had some suppleness in dealing with internal sources of discontent. In the last couple of years, the bad effects of China's industrial development. As a side note, something like 200-plus coal miners every day are killed in China. It's an incredible number. Wow. Average. And so this has been a source of controversy inside China. And so I think as a way of reducing pressure, there's been this labor rights law and some other ways to try to avoid the pressure becoming too great internally.
You know, we tend to look at hear stories like that and think, oh, my God, this, you know, it's horrible. But then we also hear that, well, compared to what the poverty in the rest of the country, people are willing to put up with these sorts of conditions and factories and so on. Is that just for American consumption or is that true?
Let me be careful to disagree with any sort of life is cheap in their other part of the world assertion. But if you look at the story of modern China from the perspective of somebody living there, you see, number one, the last 100 years have been until recently a time of continuous disaster. There was the foreign colonization and carving up of China 100 years ago. There was a Japanese invasion. There was World War II. There was civil war. There was starvation under Mao. There was the Cultural Revolution. And it's only in the last 20 or 30 years there's been any kind of normal life for anybody. So there's that, number one. And most family stories is of things materially getting better over the last 20 or 30 years. There are lots of things wrong, lots of protests about abuses of governmental power and the heavy hand of the state and people who are censored and forbidden to protest. But most families feel as if materially things have been improving. I think that's the context in which they see it.
Got an email from Jenny who writes, a recent trip to China made it clear to me that one reason for China's competitiveness against Western companies is huge infusions of government funding into new ventures like electronic games, while U.S. ventures rely on private funding, which is shrinking. Given that the Chinese economy is starting to implode along with the West's, what can the U.S. do to regain an advantage? Do you agree with the premise?
I disagree with two premises of the question. Huge amounts of government funding, yes, in that it's a communist state-run economy. Most of the airlines are still state-owned enterprises. A lot of the big businesses are state-owned. So yes, it's government infusion, but that's, as many Chinese officials have pointed out, that's less and less a distinguishing trait compared to the U.S. right now with quasi-nationalization of the banks and everything else. So I think that a different way I talk about the first premise is the fastest growing and certainly the most export successful parts of the Chinese economy have been not state funded at all. They've been associated with foreign manufacturing firms. The state has made the difference mainly in airports, in roads, in ports, in infrastructure, et cetera. Now, the Chinese economy imploding, I think that as we've been discussing, they're having a big unemployment problem now, but I would distinguish that from the collapse of the Chinese economy. And so those are my reactions.
Another email from Dennis in Puerto Rico. He writes, what do you think is behind the recent epidemic of government-sponsored Chinese hackers? The real fear is that they could paralyze bank transactions.
I think I don't know that these are government-sponsored except to the degree that everything has some government connotation in China, or almost many things do. My interpretation of this is there's a lot of everything going on in China. There's a lot of sort of clever young men with computers. And most of the hacking that I'm aware of is essentially the kind of hacking we saw in the Matthew Broderick movie War Games, I guess 25 years ago, whenever that was, of young people, a lot of time on their hands. I'm not aware of credible reports of a lot of sort of purposeful spying. It could happen. I'm not aware of that. I am aware of a whole lot of young men at their computers seeing what they can do.
A lot was made of the fact that Secretary of State Hillary Clinton's first overseas trip was to Asia. How is the new tone of the Obama administration being greeted there?
It is really weird to have been. It is weird to have been in China during the electoral cycle the last 2 years, because I think China is probably the country in the world, maybe followed by Israel, least enthusiastic about the coming of Barack Obama, at least initially. Various reasons for it. They would have voted for George Bush for a third term just because things were fine from their point of view. There's been a strong preference for the familiar. So first they would have preferred Bush, then McCain because the Republicans are more familiar to them, then Hillary Clinton because they knew her, last of all Obama.
They also have race issues.
Yes, yes. And I think that I've been surprised by the openness with which people of the last year or so said, well, how could you have a black man running your country? You know, are they ready for it? These sentiments are not unknown in the U.S., but they were more freely expressed in China. I think that now Also, it's the case that during his campaign, Obama, who was so sophisticated sounding on many issues, sounded fairly not sophisticated about China. It was all poison dog food and poison toys. I think that Hillary Clinton, when she went there, was essentially saying, it's this going to be essentially the same policy. We disagree on some political issues, and those are real disagreements, but there are areas where we have to work together. So I think that there's now an embrace of the Obama administration.
So as we're at this period in economic disruption throughout the world, what should we as Americans, do you think, what should we be hoping for the future of China and its economy?
I think it is in no one's interest in the world, starting with Chinese, but also Americans, that China have big economic problems. If they have economic disruptions leading to political disruptions, you can imagine that in 100 years' time that would lead to some democratic reform in China. In the short term, it would just mean a China which is troublesome for everybody else, which can't finance our debt, which can't do X, Y, or Z, and it's bad for 1.3 billion people. What we should really hope for is to have them continue to expand the role of liberties there and to work with us on environmental issues. Mainly, we need to attend to shoring up our own economy, our own political system, and all the rest. But if the first thing on the agenda, in my view, should be working with China on environmental and climate issues.
So we want them to succeed, but not to our detriment.
Correct. We want them to succeed because it's good for them. It's good and has been. It'll be better for us in general if they succeed than if they don't.
Got it. That's James Fallows. You've read his writings for many, many years in The Atlantic. He's got the cover story in the upcoming April issue. It's called China's Way Forward. And you've read probably several of his books as well. His new one is called Postcards from Tomorrow Square, Reports from China. Jim Fallows, good to have you back.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
In our next hour of Forum, we're going to be shifting gears a little, but not entirely. We're going to be talking about the San Francisco International Asian American Film Festival, which is underway here in the city. We'll be talking with a couple of directors who have films in the festival, along with the director and a former director as well. So stay with us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.